Hey, folks, thanks for checking out the podcast. Just want to let you know, May 2nd to the 4th, I'm on the road doing stand-up at Rick Bronson's House of Comedy in Bloomington, Minnesota. Come on out. Giant mall. Who doesn't love a mall? Spend money, eat, put on weight. It's a good deal. May 2nd to the 4th, always a great time in Bloomington. Great, great crowds. Always enjoy working the club. You go to Rick Bronson's House of Comedy online, you get tickets. That's May 2nd to the 4th. Hope you can make it. And please, if you're not following me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Paul Mercurio, M-E-C-U-R-I-O. We'd love you to do it. We put a lot of cool stuff out there on the platform. So enjoy my guests this week, and hopefully we'll see you in Bloomington or on the social media. My guest this week, DEA special agent in charge, Jack Riley, led the manhunt for El Chapo, has an incredible history in law enforcement in this country, and has a new book out, Drug Warrior, which chronicles the hunt for El Chapo. Nice to have you on the show, Jack.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So there's so many places to start. I know you were based out of El Paso, the El Paso field office. So talking about El Chapo for a minute, why was it so hard to finally capture him with so many countries, especially America, interested in him? What was the stumbling block or blocks?
Well, I think he was probably the most unique high value target that we've worked. And the main reason was he was extremely well entrenched. He was a guy that kind of learned from the mistakes of Pablo Escobar. For at least the first 10 to 15 years, he really kept a low profile and did most of his work from hideouts in the mountains of Sinaloa, extremely rural, you know, not much law enforcement. And he really controlled the surroundings. But I have to say, the reason I think it was so difficult was that he was in virtually every corner in terms of corruption of the Mexican government, from the local municipal police to the local prosecutors to the federal police. So part of our problem in the nearly 20 years I was involved in the hunt was trying to find our counterparts in Mexico in which we could build bridges of trust and share information. And that really didn't occur until a couple of years ago where we were able to work with the Mexican Marines, who, in my opinion, are heroes. We would have not been able to capture Chapo and certainly extradite him had it not been for the cooperative effort we had with them.
Why were the Marines so impervious to his, you know, his money and his power and, you know, being corrupt? What was special about them?
They really are an elite unit amongst the Mexican military apparatus, and much of their training, I'm happy to say, was provided by the United States, specifically the Marines. So they were encouraged. They were vetted. To get into the Marines is difficult. You have to be vetted, which means polygraph, all kinds of other background checks. And that's highly unusual in Mexico and actually Central and South America. So this was a crew of dedicated, very small outfit, dedicated, really very proud of their country and wanted to do the right thing. And when you see the way they operate and how they keep to themselves, because they are so concerned of the impression of corruption, it's really amazing. And I think it's a lesson for some of the other struggling countries where narco trafficking has really affected them.
What were some of the big lessons from Pablo Escobar that he learned one of them, I assume, keep a low profile?
It was keep a low profile, but Chapo was brought up at a time when he was really trained as a smuggler, not necessarily a narcotic trafficker. And in doing that, he built alliances with various territorial groups that he had to deal with in terms of passing illegal goods to the U.S. border and then on into the United States for profit. So he had an organization, I think, in place for many, many years. He had a couple of really good mentors. And one of the things I think was really important about Chapo, you know, he's a mass murderer. Don't kid yourself. Mm. But he's also one hell of a corporate CEO. He saw the value of organization. He understood corruption's important. He understood the threat of violence is important, but the overused violence can be bad for business.
How can the overuse in that world of violence be bad for business?
Because it draws attention to the business itself. I'm kind of a perfect example. When I was sent down in 2006 to head the El Paso field division, which really encompasses about a third of the Mexican border, you know, I had some marching orders, was to go after Sinaloa and obviously do everything we could to work with our Mexican counterparts and our agents already in Mexico to bring that organization to its knees. And in doing that, I kind of naively gave a interview to the local newspaper, in which I laid out why I was there and what I planned on doing. And Chapo didn't like it. And shortly after that, he put a bounty on my head. And it was an important time to understand the safety of U.S. agents in Mexico along the border, because never before had we seen an organization, I think, that powerful and vicious, that really could come through with those threats. But Chapo did understand, you know, if you kidnap or hurt a U.S. agent, whether they be in Mexico or along the border or domestic city, it's going to bring the holy hell of the U.S. government down. And I think he was around when my colleague, Kiki Camarena, was obviously kidnapped and brutally murdered. So he understood, in terms of business sense, what you had to do to keep your rivals away with the threat of violence. And sometimes, obviously, he did use violence to move his organization forward. But in terms of law enforcement, I think he knew it was not a good move for him. If you look at Pablo Escobar, I think he was responsible for killing tens of thousands of policemen. Mm. So he obviously had a different way of doing business.
Yeah. You talk about the opioid epidemic and Purdue Pharma, and that, you know, Chapo saw what was happening with the opioid prescription meds in the U.S. and flooded the market with cheap heroin. Before that, was it cocaine and marijuana the main thing that he was trafficking in, or was it always heroin, but he upped the ante with the opioid epidemic? And how did his business model change?
Well, he was really a poly drug trafficker. Prior to the prescription drug problem in this country, which obviously led to opioid addiction, he was heavily involved in the movement of cocaine, methamphetamine, and also marijuana. But I think what he did was he saw the prescription drug problem coming. He understood that at some point the doctor would say no, the pharmacist would say no, and you really couldn't steal your way out of prescription drugs. I mean, there's only so much in your friend's medicine cabinet.
Right.
And it's all opioid based. So what happens when you get down that road, whether it started from a legitimate prescription or you were using it illegally from the beginning, your really only alternative is to go to high grade cheap heroin. And at the time, I was the boss in Chicago in 2010 to 15, and we really saw it turn the city around, because heroin at that time was being smoked and snorted much like cocaine. So the fear of the needle and AIDS and hepatitis really was gone. And you were seeing a completely different group of users, you know, affluent suburban people who had found themselves addicted to prescription drugs. And it really changed the market. And it also changed, I think, the level of violence and homicide that we had to deal with in Chicago, because Chapo was smart enough to really form a toxic business relationship with the nearly 100,000 street gang members in Chicago who largely make their living selling drugs, and they were selling his drugs. And he could care less who they shot to protect their territory. So it was really, it emerged very quickly, and it was a mess. And if you look at how it's progressed from there, now we're dealing with fentanyl, which is, you know, 40 to 50 times stronger than street-level heroin.
So what are your thoughts on these? I know you have some pretty strong thoughts on the pharma execs and, you know, these execs at these pharmaceutical companies that have been essentially pushing this stuff. And I know that there's a bankruptcy filing, but, you know, from where you sit and with all your experience and all these years in this world, like, how do you view them?
I prior to my retirement, I was the number two of the deputy administrator of DEA, and I oversaw all the enforcement actions worldwide. And time again, our diversion investigators and our special agents would put together very, very detailed, complex investigations into the diversion of legitimate drugs on these big three or four companies. Criminally, we would go after them criminally. And then at the last minute, either the Department of Justice or specific congressmen would raise issue with it, and we would have to settle for a civil fine.
What do you mean by diversion of legitimate drugs? What does that mean?
Well, the narcotic side of the house, or the street level, is handled by DEA special agents, the okay. gun carriers. Mm-hmm. The regulatory side of DEA, which is just as crucial, is regulatory of the legitimate supply. So pharmaceutical companies, physicians, people that can prescribe. And time again, we would build cases during our audits to show bad record keeping, that, you know, missing truckloads of narcotics, just a total disregard for regulations and laws. And it was done so repetitively by these billion-dollar companies. So our thought was, let's go after the executives that oversee that, because I really believe if we put, you know, some Brooks Brothers suit CEO, Harvard guy, you know, in the federal pen with some real felons, we would send a message throughout the industry that we weren't fooling around anymore.
Yeah.
But because of the relationship, the cozy relationship Congress has with many of these pharmaceutical companies and the industry in general, it's a real tough thing to do, I'm telling you.
Boy, I tell you, as you say that, it sounds like just a well-dressed up El Chapo situation, where he's got the law enforcement people in his pocket and these drug companies have the elected officials in their pocket. I'm not saying that they're murderers, but it's not too far off from what El Chapo was doing, in a way.
You know, you're exactly right. I mean, and that's what used to really tick me off about, sure, we could fine one of these big pharma companies $100 million, but you know what? That's like taking a truckload of narco dollars from Chapo. It's built into the business plan. It's the cost of doing business.
Yeah.
Whereas if you lock up an executive who knowingly and willingly, went around laws and regulations and looked the other way, I'm telling you, it would have scared the hell out of them.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because one of the things I was thinking about in reading the book and getting ready for the interview was, what can our elected officials do to try to corral this problem? We're never going to eliminate the entire problem of illegal drugs, but and particularly the trafficking of drugs into America, particularly from Mexico. But what could they do? Obviously, it sounds like one thing is to close their pockets up from the drug companies. But what else could they do to help guys like you do what you do?
Well, I think they need to put the money where their mouth is, you know, and you got to remember, I was a cop. I'm not a politician.
Right.
But I did have to testify numerous times in front of Congress, and the questions in which they asked were so political in nature that it was clear to me they didn't understand. I tell the story in the book of a congressman that was called to brief one day, and he was so busy that I briefed him in the hallway, and I was talking specifically about his district and the gang issue we had there with the Mexican cartels and how they were working together. And at the end of it, he looked at me and he said, "How do you guys have time to do that and check meat?" He actually thought we were the USDA.
Oh my God.
On it. And this is a guy that controls his purse strings. So if you look at DEA's budget, we're authorized, at least when I left, about 5,300 special agents. And that's to take care of 120 offices domestically. And I think we have 64 offices in some 40 countries around the world. And we're down about, I think, at least 1,000 to 1,200 agents.
Mm.
Now, they're authorized. In other words, Congress authorized, but they won't fund it. And, you know, if you look at ATF, they're in the same situation. If Congress really wanted to do something, they would do that. I also think we have to maintain a very strong and robust enforcement stance, both domestically and overseas. And I think the Chapo relationship we built with the Mexicans really shows the value of that. But so much of what we do in foreign countries is institution building, you know, teaching these countries, specifically Central South America, parts of Africa, you know, what the rule of law is, setting up laws and regulations and their own type of DEA to carry on these investigations, because all of that information is crucial to going after these large cartels. And you always have to keep in the back of your mind the connection between terrorist and narco trafficking. And I just don't think the American people have made that connection, and I don't think members of Congress have seen it either.
What can you explain, elaborate on that? What is the connection? How does it work, that connection?
Well, primarily, if you look at, I mean, Afghanistan is a great example. When Afghanistan was in full swing in terms of military operations, DEA agents actually had several teams of agents that would go out with special forces to try to attack opium production, because we knew that the money that was generated by the Taliban from opium sales, eventually into heroin from across the world, was going to funnel terrorism. So that was a crucial link. You also saw it with Hamas, obviously the FARC in Colombia. All of these terrorist organizations make money from narcotics. So if we don't attack those links, we really are providing, I think, a misservice to the public about our own national security.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room, and I'm not looking to get political here. This idea of building the wall, building a bigger wall, et cetera, which is, you know, obviously front and center. And, you know, the argument is there's a lot of bad stuff coming in from Mexico, obviously drugs being one of them, but criminals and blah, blah, blah. Does a wall, does the wall that, you know, they want to build, does that stop this? It sounds like El Chapo, from what I had read and seen, and, you know, he was very sophisticated in the ways he could get smuggled things into this country. Does a wall stop this at all?
Here's what I'll say about that. And you know, I've been screaming about the border since I was a boss down there, the limited resources we have. So I'm glad the administration is looking at it. Now, I do think a wall would probably help in the illegal alien migration. But I don't think it's going to have a major impact on narcotics unless we enhance our technology at the ports of entry, because that's where the majority of the high volume amount of narcotics come through. I mean, you only have to look, there was a month and a half ago where coming through one of the port of entries, a truck was x-rayed, very sophisticated trap, and it turned out to be the largest fentanyl seizure in history. Well, we would not have gotten that without enough technology. So I think we need to do both. I really think we need to do both. And I hope this administration understands that. You know, there's an old saying on the border, you know, you build a 10-foot wall, I'm going to get an 11-foot ladder. And there's some truth to that. And if you look at Chapo's ability to tunnel under our border and out of prison, I still think, you know, the ports of entry. I think the other thing people don't get about the ports of entry is one of the reasons, you know, there's thousands of cars, trucks, buses that come through there every day. And a lot of it is legitimate commerce, which affects the economy of both countries. But if you clear a checkpoint, you're right on the interstate highway system in this country, and you can go anywhere. Whereas if you bring a large volume of narcotics across a desolate, unwalled desert, first of all, it's tough to do. And second of all, you're still going to have to make it to the arteries to bring it to market. So it just doesn't make real good business sense, I think, for the sophisticated cartels to do that.
Do you think legalizing these drugs, heroin, you know, we're getting there with marijuana. Do you think that that model puts these guys out of business and controls the problem from where you sit?
I just think it's a terrible idea. What it would do to our social services, our work productivity, our hospitals, it would devastate them. And here's the key: it would never eliminate the black market. So we'd still have the same organizations trying to undercut, trying to control the market with a cheaper, more important drug. You know, and I say it in the book, look, this is a problem we're going to be wrestling with for the rest of our existence. How we choose to confront it is really the national dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a couple of things that we have not done. The mm-hmm. way we educate people, look, I'm not saying it's bad, but to send a uniformed community policeman into a third grade classroom and talk about the evils of drugs, I don't think that's enough. Mm-hmm. We have to go after the user, the at-risk groups, the high school, the college, the young professionals, people that find themselves in the grips of addiction from legitimate prescribing. Mm-hmm. And people, number one, is that want treatment. Now, maybe it's not available or they can't afford it, but they want to change their lives. I'm not talking about violent offenders or traffickers. Let's let our prison systems deal with those. Mm-hmm. We have to start thinking that way. The educational side of what we're doing, really, if you look at heroin and fentanyl now, it involves everybody. Mothers, fathers, teachers, preachers, you know, our policymakers, everybody plays a role in this, because for so many years, a lot of people were thinking, oh, this only happens in the inner city. It is in virtually every corner of the country, cities large and small, rural and urban. And it has to be addressed like that.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I didn't think about it in those terms or look at it in that way. Is there anybody out there that replaces El Chapo? When you get a guy like that, does the snake still live? You just new head grows, or how does that play out in that world?
Well, unfortunately, many of the cartels are much like the military. When a general is removed or killed, somebody's willing to step up.
Yeah.
Right now, Sinaloa, we shuttered Sinaloa, and that's an important thing, because when you make a devastating hit, a guy like Chapo, the organization itself goes into turmoil. People begin to not trust each other, alliances break down, communications become vulnerable, and that's where law enforcement can do sustained damage. Mm-hmm. Now, where Sinaloa is now, probably Chapo's two sons, who aren't the brightest, who just got indicted in the United States, by the way, are trying to maintain control. And then the elder is a guy by the name of Miles Zambada,
mm-hmm.
Who is still, was really Chapo's partner. He's still out and still involved. So that's kind of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And normally you're going to see an enhanced war down there in terms of people trying to position themselves. We've seen increased violence, but not to the extent I thought we would.
Do you think that we can continue to evolve in terms of our methods of law enforcement to keep up? Because it seems like it's a one-upmanship game, right? Like you put on a highly sophisticated X-ray machine that sees the fentanyl in a truck. Well, then they figure out to get a better truck that you can't see through. How is that game? Are we winning at that game or losing at that game?
Well, unfortunately, the law enforcement in the U.S. has limited resources and has to play by the rules.
Yeah.
Chapo had unlimited resources and made up the rules. I think one of the things we should start a national debate about is using the State Department criteria for terrorist organizations and identify the major cartels and mm-hmm. designate them as mm-hmm. such. That brings in a completely different set of tools that we can use, and obviously additional monies. Mm-hmm. I think we need to start thinking that way, because if you look at Sinaloa and you're honest, and I almost know too much about these people, I don't think we've ever encountered a criminal entity that large, well-financed, and vicious in our generation. One of the most important things we accomplished was to extradite him.
Mm.
That sent a message, I think, across the narco world and also to some terrorists, that we can reach out and get you.
Yeah.
But to accomplish that, you got to have relationships with foreign governments. So, that's why I get concerned with all the political rhetoric about the Mexican people and the condescending tweets. All of those things can affect our ability to operate in foreign countries.
That's a good point. Well, listen, this has been really fascinating. I was really glad that, that I was able to talk to you. This is a great book. It's Drug Warrior. It's DEA Special Agent in Charge, Jack Riley. You'll get a big education, and it's also an interesting read as well. And I think it's really great to hear from a guy on the ground how to solve some of these problems, as opposed to a politician in a Brooks Brothers suit, maybe who's a little bit disconnected from it all. So I think it's really valuable that you have a book like this out there.
Well, thank you.
Great to have you on. Jack Riley, everybody.
All right, there you go, Jack Riley. How cool is this? This guy's life is a movie. I could have talked to him all day. Amazing. Hope you enjoyed it. May 2nd to the 4th, Bloomington, Minnesota. If you're in the area, come on out. I'm going to be at Rick Bronson's House of Comedy, May 2nd to the 4th. You can go online and get tickets for that. And please follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, @PaulMercurio. Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.